Thanks, Dennis. I'm going to talk about some work I've been doing in the last couple of years. The talk will be in two parts. The first part is talking about threshold behavior for epidemics on graphs, and the second part is on curing strategies. By the way, can you hear me at the back?
Yeah, okay.
And a couple of things before I start. Please feel free to stop me if you have any questions at any time. And the second is I have to confess that this is more a maths talk than a biology talk, so you might find the models a bit simplistic, but hopefully the intuition is still there and there might be qualitative insights that you'll still find useful. Okay, the first part of the talk is for thresholds for epidemics, and this is joint work with Laurent Massoulier, who used to be at Microsoft Research and is now with Thomson in Paris, and with Don Towsley, who's at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Let me start by describing the model. We have a graph G with an undirected graph with the vertex set V and an edge set E. Each node can be in one of two possible states, infected or healthy, and X sub V is the indicator that a node is infected. And we have the usual SIS epidemic or the contact process on this graph. Just to remind you what that is, every healthy node can become infected. That's the transition from 0 to 1, and that happens with rate, which is some infection rate beta, pairwise infection rate beta, times the number of infected neighbors that the node has. And every infected node gets cured at some constant rate delta. Okay. And clearly the state, if you define the state as this, which set of nodes is infected, then the state evolves as a continuous time Markov process. I don't think I have to say much by way of motivation to this audience. It's a model for certain biological epidemics where the pathogen is mutating rapidly. So even when you recover from the epidemic, recover from the disease, you don't have long-term immunity to it. And in our model, that's captured by the fact that as soon as you're healthy, you're susceptible again. Okay, so possibly this is a model for tuberculosis, as we heard this morning. Certainly for the common cold, it's a valid model. It could also be used to model computer viruses and worms. That's the perspective from which my motivation for working on these came from. At present, viruses don't mutate, or computer viruses don't mutate, so if you patch your computer against something, you're protected forever. But in future, you could imagine that people might write viruses which do mutate, and then these models are relevant. And they're also relevant when studying failures in computer networks or electrical power networks where you have a cascade of failures. Okay, so there are some situations where the model is appropriate. In other situations, you might want something else, like an SIR model. Other things that this simple model ignores are incubation periods, for instance. We have, for simplicity, assumed that the infectivity period is exponential. That's a Markovian assumption. You might want to consider more general distributions. But we have kept the model simple because what we want to focus on is how does this topology, this underlying graph structure, affect the epidemic. And so we want to keep other aspects of the modeling simple. Okay, so coming back to the description, the epidemic is a Markov process on where each node can be in one of two states, 0 denoting healthy or 1 denoting infected. This Markov process has an absorbing state at 0. What I mean by that is that if all nodes are healthy, then the epidemic can never come back into the population. It's a closed population. So eventually you hit the state where everybody is healthy, and at that point the epidemic has died out. So let's denote by capital T the time to hit this absorbing state. And what we want to know is how does this lifetime of the epidemic depend on the infection rate beta, the cure rate delta, and on the shape of the graph. It might seem that this model is quite uninteresting. After all, it's a it's an absorbing Markov chain, and it's going to get absorbed. So what's going to happen here? Well, it turns out that you can get some quite subtle behavior. And before I go to discuss the finite graphs, let me recall some results known for infinite lattices, where it's known that there is a phase transition. So let's say you have an infinite d-dimensional lattice and fix the cure rate to be 1. If you increase the infection rate beta, there's a critical beta C such that if your infection rate is below this critical parameter, then the epidemic will eventually die out. Whereas if you are above this critical parameter, then with some positive probability, the epidemic will live forever. Now, on an infinite lattice, it is possible for an epidemic to live forever, whereas on a finite graph, that can't happen. But is there some way in which this phase transition manifests itself in finite graphs as well? And this is how it happens. So this is, in finite lattices, what Duret and Liu showed is the following. They considered a one-dimensional lattice on n nodes. So n nodes in a line or in a ring, it doesn't matter. Then if you are below the critical parameter, then the time for the epidemic to die out, let's say you start with all nodes infected initially, the time for the epidemic to die out is logarithmic in the number of nodes. Whereas if you are above the critical parameter, then the time for the epidemic to die out is exponential in the number of nodes. So there's this very sharp transition between epidemics which die out quickly and which live for a very long time. So, and this happens very sharply as you pass through the critical value. So that's how the phase transition still manifests itself on finite graphs. That's for the one-dimensional lattice, and this result has been extended to d-dimensional lattices by Liget. As far as I'm aware, when we started, results were only known for lattices. And our work has been to try and extend it to more general graphs. So in the rest of the talk, what I want to do is give some general conditions under which epidemics will die out quickly on arbitrary graphs, some general conditions under which they will live for a long time. In certain graph models, these conditions will match each other. In some other models, they won't match each other. And then there are some special techniques to deal with some of those models, at least. And in the last part of the talk, I'll discuss optimal curing strategies. Optimal in some sense. Okay, so let me start by introducing some notation. As before, we have a graph G, n vertices, the edges are denoted E. So we'll denote the adjacency matrix of the graph by A. The adjacency matrix of a graph is a square matrix, n by n matrix. There's a 1 in the ijth position if there's an edge between node I and node j, and otherwise there's a 0. So it's a 0, 1 positive matrix. We'll denote by rho the spectral radius of this matrix, meaning its largest eigenvalue, which is positive by the Baron-Frobenius theorem. For the epidemic on this model, there was a phase transition conjectured at a value. It was conjectured by these people who are computer scientists that if the infection rate times the spectral radius is smaller than the cure rate, then the epidemic dies out. And above that, the epidemic survives forever, which can't be correct because on a finite graph, it can't survive forever. But in fact, and they conjectured this for general graphs, which is also not true, but there is something to this. So we got interested in this by trying to establish this result rigorously. And what we can show is that this does give one bound in the correct direction. It does give, this is a general condition for when epidemics die out quickly. So that's our first result. So the result is that if beta times rho is smaller than delta, then the probability that the epidemic hasn't died out by time t is decaying exponentially in t. And from this it follows that the mean lifetime of the epidemic is bounded by log n divided by delta minus beta rho. So if this quantity is positive, then the epidemic dies out quickly. That's the result. Okay, and the proof is actually quite simple. It's based on branching random walk bound. So let me tell you what this is. We have this epidemic process which we denoted X sub V, under which each node can be in one of two states, infected or cured or healthy. Let's bound it by the Y process, which you can think of as follows. Imagine that there's an infinite population at each node, and Y will keep track of how many individuals at each node are infected. And each infective at a given node can cause an infection at an adjacent node with rate beta as before. So the number of infectives at node V goes up by 1 at rate beta times the number of infectives at adjacent nodes. Or in matrix notation, it's beta times the adjacency matrix times Y. And also each individual gets cured independently at rate delta. Okay, so it should be clear from this description, hopefully, that the Y process is always bigger than the X process, because you have at least one infective at each node and possibly more. And the advantage of doing things this way is that whereas the X process is quite nonlinear, the epidemic process, the evolution of Y is going to be linear. As a result of that, if you look at the expectation of Y, it obeys this differential equation, matrix differential equation. Its time derivative is beta times the adjacency matrix minus delta times the identity times Y, E. There should be an E, I guess, expectation of Y of T. And so you can solve it explicitly to find the expectation of the number of Y at any time. And because X is smaller than Y, the probability that the epidemic hasn't died out is bounded by the probability that Y hasn't died out, which is bounded by its expectation because it's integer value. So if it's not zero, it's at least one. Okay, so this gives you, this tells you that the probability of the epidemic not having died out is decaying exponentially in T, provided that this matrix has negative eigenvalues, which is the same as saying that beta times the spectral radius is smaller than delta. Okay, so that was a kind of a linear algebra proof. There's also a probabilistic interpretation, which is equally simple, which is just the union bound. So if you look at what the probability is that a certain node V is infected at time t, how can this happen? You have to start with some other node U initially being infected, and there has to be a path along which the infection goes from U to V over this time period T. So you can just bound the probability of this happening by a sum over all initial infectives and a sum over all paths of different lengths along which the infection can go from U to V. And this is the probability that the infection does go in k steps from U to V. So then if you just calculate that sum, then the number of paths of different lengths k, so the number of paths of length k is given by the kth power of the adjacency matrix, so that grows like the largest eigenvalue to the power k. So that's why the spectral radius comes into the bound. It's just a union bound calculation. Okay. So that's the result and its interpretation. Okay. And certain generalizations of this are quite straightforward. We didn't need to. So we assume, for instance, that all pairwise infectivities are the same, that they are beta. You don't need that. You can allow for different infectivities in the model. So you could have, say, two-level models, household model, and different infectivities for random pairs as opposed to within the household. That's easy to include in this model. You could have, instead of a constant cure rate, you can allow different cure rates for different individuals to model the fact that their health status may be different. And in all these cases, the result still holds, and what it says is that if the infectivity matrix B minus the cure matrix D, if this difference has negative spectral radius, then the epidemic dies out quickly. Okay, so that's one direction. Under what conditions does the epidemic survive for a long time? We can get bounds on that based on a generalization on a quantity known as the isoperimetric constant or the conductance or the expansion of a graph. Different people use different terms. You may have heard one or more of them. And that's defined as follows. So let's take a number m between 1 and n over 2. Eta sub m is defined as follows. You look at any subset of nodes consisting of m or fewer nodes and look at how many edges cross from the subset to the rest of the graph. So if you think of the set S, if you think of the number of nodes within S as the area of that set and the number of edges crossing it as the perimeter of the set, the ratio of perimeter to area is some measure of how much the graph expands. And you look at the minimum of this overall possible sets of size up to M. So you look at the worst case ratio of perimeter to area is called the isoperimetric constant of this graph, or the conductance. And in particular, for the value M equals N over 2, that's what's known as the isoperimetric constant, and that turns up in certain applications, such as if you're studying random walks on this graph and how quickly they mix to the stationary distribution, then that's related to the spectral gap of the random walk, and you can get bounds for the spectral gap in terms of the isoperimetric constant. That's just to tell you that there are other applications of this quantity as well. But for us, it arises more naturally because the way the epidemic spreads out from some given set is along edges going out of that set. So that's why it's relevant to us. Just a couple of examples to make sure you've understood the concept. So for example, let's calculate what this quantity is for some specific graphs. If you have the binary tree, then the isoperimetric constant is bounded below by 1. If it's a tree with degree, if it's a k-array tree, then this would be k minus 1 instead of 1. So for example, here is a subset of nodes. There are 7 nodes here and there are 8 edges going out. So it's, the ratio is 8 over 7. And if you make m large, it will get close to 1. And in the case of a lattice, it would go to 0 because there are, if you look at a k by k lattice, say in 2 dimensions, there are k squared nodes here and roughly k edges going out, 4k edges going out. So again, that would go to 0. Okay, any questions? Okay, so then we can give a condition under which epidemics die out slowly. So if the infection rate beta times the isoperimetric constant at scale m, if this product is bigger than the cure rate delta and the ratio is r, then we can show that the epidemics survive for time which is exponential in n. And in particular, if the graph is an expander for large m, so if you can choose m like some fractional power of n, then this epidemic survives for time which is exponential in n as well. So m is a free parameter which you can choose to optimize your results for particular graphs. Okay. The idea of the proof is again quite simple. So let's count the number of infected nodes denoted by the cardinality of x. Say at some time that there are k infected nodes in the graph, then by definition of the isoperimetric constant, that says that the number of edges going from infected nodes to susceptible nodes is at least eta times k. I've dropped the subscript m to keep the notation simple. And so the rate at which new nodes become infected is at least the infection rate beta times the number of edges, and the rate at which nodes are getting cured is delta times the number of infected nodes. Okay, and so what this means is that the number of infected nodes, which is not a Markov process because you need to know which nodes are infected, but that process dominates a certain Markov process on 0 through m, and the process Z goes up by 1 at rate beta times eta, as explained above, and goes down by 1 at rate delta. And by our assumption, if this if the product of the infection rate and the isoperimetric constant is bigger than the cure rate, then this random walk is more likely to go up than to go down, which means it'll return to n exponentially many times before it hits zero, starting from any non-zero value. So it'll take exponentially long for the epidemic to die out. And this is just the gambler's ruin problem. Okay, so to summarize, I guess I should also mention that, again, these results, so we can also generalize this rather than assume a constant infection rate beta and a constant cure rate delta. We could make them dependent on the node or the edge, and you would suitably change your definition of the conductance. So instead of just counting the number of edges, the edges would now have weights attached to them, which tell you what the infectivity is on the edge. And down here, instead of just counting the number of nodes, you would have a weight for each node, which tells you how quickly it's cured. And if the conductance so defined is bigger than one, then you have epidemics which survive for a long time. Okay, so to summarize, we have certain general conditions under which the epidemic survives for a long time or dies out quickly. And these conditions would match provided the spectral radius was the same as the isoperimetric constant or very close to it. So we can ask, are there graphs for which this is true and for which this is not true? Okay, so here are some examples. Let's start with the complete graph. This is interesting because this is the graph for which classical differential equation models are appropriate, because such models assume homogeneity and perfect mixing, and if you have a complete graph, those assumptions are satisfied. So this is where mean field models are appropriate. For this graph, the spectral radius is n minus 1. For any regular graph, the spectral radius is the degree, and here the degree is n minus 1. And the isoperimetric constant at scale n is n minus m, because if you take any m nodes, then there are edges going out to the remaining n minus m nodes. So you can take m to be epsilon n or some fractional power of m. Either way, you get that the isoperimetric constant is very close to the spectral radius. So you can show that in these graphs, you do have a sharp threshold, and the threshold is at the ratio of infection rate to cure rate equals 1 over n. And this is the classical result you get in a differential equation model corresponding to the reproductive number, because the reproductive number is beta divided by delta, beta times n divided by delta, because beta times n is the number of nodes you infect before you infect nodes at rate beta times n and you die out at rate delta. So this result just says what we know well, that there is an epidemic if you are above the, if the reproductive ratio is bigger than one, and there's no epidemic if it's smaller than one. Okay, another graph where you can get results easily is a certain classical random graph model due to Edrich Renyi, who introduced it in the 1960s. So the graph is constructed as follows. You have n nodes. You put an edge between each pair of nodes with some probability p that may depend on n. So we can denote it p sub n. But these edges are all independent of each other. So the edge between any given pair of nodes is independent of whether edges between some other pair of nodes is present or absent. For these graphs, it is known that there is a threshold for connectivity at an average degree of log n. So if each node has fewer than log n neighbors, then with high probability the graph is not connected. And if it has more than log n neighbors, then with high probability the graph is connected. So let's work in the regime where the graph is connected. So I'll assume that the edge probability is at least a constant log n over n. In that case, we can calculate the isoperimetric constant. It's also bounded above by C 1 plus epsilon log n. Spectral radius. The isoperimetric constant is bounded below by some other constant times log n. There is a gap because, well, the isoperimetric constant cannot be bigger than the minimum degree of the graph, and you might have a few low degree nodes. So when you're very close to the connectivity threshold, the degrees of different nodes are some constant times log n, but they don't concentrate. They can be different constants times log n. So in this case, there's a small gap between the two bounds we have. So we don't know whether or not there's a sharp threshold for the epidemic in this graph. But if you go into the dense regime where the mean degree grows faster than log n, then indeed the degree distributions at all the nodes concentrate around the mean degree. And so you can show that the spectral radius and the isoperimetric constant do match in that case. And then you do have a threshold. Okay, so we've seen a couple of graphs where these bounds match each other, more or less. Let's look at some bad examples where they don't. Back to the simple example of a one-dimensional lattice. So the degree is 2 for each node, therefore the spectral radius is 2. But the isoperimetric constant is going to 0, because if you take m nodes adjacent to each other, there are just 2 edges going out of this chunk of nodes. So the ratio of edges to nodes is 2 over m, that's going to 0. So the spectral radius bound tells us that the critical infectivity rate is bigger than 1/2. The isoperimetric constant is useless. It's useless on lattices in any dimension. It just tells us that there may be, well, it doesn't even tell us whether there is going to be a critical parameter. But it is known in this case that by people doing percolation that the critical parameter is somewhere between 1.5 and 2. So in particular, neither of our bounds is tight, and one of them is completely useless, in fact. So I just wanted to say that this doesn't always work. There are some graphs for which these techniques work and other graphs for which they don't. It would be very nice if they worked for all graphs, but we don't have that. Here's another example where they don't work, but we can study directly. So this is the star network, which consists of a central hub and end leaves. This, you can calculate the eigenvalues of this graph. The spectral radius is the square root of n, and the isoperimetric constant is 1, because if you take any subset of the leaves, there's only one edge per leaf. So there is a huge gap between these two. But it turns out that, in fact, the spectral radius bound is the correct one. And because this is such a simple graph, we can study it directly. You can model the epidemic on this graph by a two-state Markov process. You only have to keep track of whether the hub is infected or not and how many leaves are infected. So that's quite simple, and we can analyze it directly. And what we find is the following. So if the ratio of infection rate to cure rate is smaller than any constant divided by square root of n, then the epidemic dies out quickly. The general result would only tell us that if this is smaller than 1 over square root n, it dies out quickly. So in fact, it's not exactly at the threshold, but it's at the right scaling. And we can also show that if this ratio grows a little bit faster, so if it grows like a tiny power of n divided by square root n, then the epidemic lives for a long time. So the threshold is not quite as sharp. It's a softer threshold, but there is a threshold at 1 over square root n, roughly. And we can also tell what the typical behavior of the epidemic is like. If you look at what happens above the critical in this supercritical region, then what happens is that typically you get the hub, you go through cycles where the hub is infected or cured. When it's infected, it infects about square root n of its neighbors, then it gets cured. There are enough infected neighbors that they'll reinfect it, and so on. So what has to happen is you have to make a big jump from you have to cure all of your infected neighbors in one big jump before the hub gets reinfected. And that's so you have a kind of metastable state with around square root n leaves infected. So let's go on to look at power law graphs. So what are these? These are graphs where you have the number of vertices with a given degree is decaying polynomially in the degree with some, like some power k to the minus gamma of the degree k. And this differs from the classical Edith-Renyi model, for example, where the number of vertices with degree k would decay exponentially with k, or with other classical models like regular graphs where it's even more concentrated than that. So what this says is that there are more high degree nodes than you would expect. And why might we be interested in such graphs? Well, it appears that there's some evidence that these are quite widespread, both in natural networks and in engineered networks. Though admittedly, not everybody agrees on the evidence. Somebody was mentioning in a talk yesterday that people find Andrew, that was on Tuesday, on the Albatross Levy flights, that whenever people look for power laws, they find them because they are not careful enough. So it might just be a case of that. So just to give you some examples of where power laws have been claimed, it's been claimed for the core connectivity graph of the internet, the graph connecting core routers in the internet, and it was claimed that the power is 2.1. This was in a paper by Palutsos. This result has been questioned by these authors, who say that in fact it may be an artifact of the trace route algorithm, which is what they use to collect their data. So what you do is you pick some collection of nodes and you send out messages to a lot of other nodes and ask it to report back the route it took, and from that you try to infer the topology of the internet. Nobody knows the real topology, it's just too big. And so if you start out your paths from a small subset of nodes, even if you're sampling a lot of them, most of your paths go through routers quite close to where you started out from, and that gives the impression that these routers have much higher degree. So it could be an artifact of the measurement procedure rather than an underlying fact of the internet. Similar results have also been claimed for the connectivity graph between web pages, and it was claimed for the number of sexual partners in a paper by Lilheros et al. Though a log normal has also been proposed as an alternative model, and that doesn't have a power law distribution. So it's there's some evidence for power laws, but at this stage it's still open. Okay, why might we expect power laws? There are some generative models that give rise to them naturally. In the case of graphs, you get power laws if you have some kind of preferential attachment. So think of a graph or a network growing in some way. A new node comes in and wants to join the network, and it does so by attaching itself to one of the existing nodes. Typically, what might happen is that it's more likely to attach to high degree nodes, which are in some sense well known, than to a random node. So high degree nodes are more likely to increase in degree, and that kind of preferential growth can give rise to power laws. And that was the model proposed by Parabashi and Albert quite recently. In fact, power laws have been known for a long time in a number of subjects, and people have proposed models for it. Back in the 1920s, Yule proposed a model for how, for the number of species in a genus, and this is a multiplicative growth model because any species in a genus may split into two subspecies, and multiplicative growth gives rise to power laws. Herbert Simon studied the distribution of a number of things like income and city sizes, which seem to exhibit power laws as well, and again by some kind of preferential attachment model. And there's a nice survey paper on this topic. Okay, so what can we say about epidemics on such graphs? There was a lot of interest in a paper by Pastor Satoras and Vespignani, who claimed that the epidemics on such graphs have a zero threshold, meaning that for any non-zero infection rate, there will be a big epidemic on the graph. And their results were based on mean field models. There was more rigorous analysis done by Berger, Bogues, Chase, and Saberi around the same time as our work independently, and they got, well, quite similar results to us. I'll tell you what the differences are as well. So also confirming that there is a zero epidemic threshold. We also show that there's a zero threshold, but we also characterize how the threshold approaches zero as a function of n, the number of nodes. Okay, so we are going to, in order to do that, we are going to work with a specific model of a power law graph, and a number of different models have been proposed which are quite similar. We'll work with a model which was proposed by Fan Cheng and Lin Yuan Lu. Actually, well, it was proposed by Bolobash, but studied in more detail by these people in this context. The idea is the following. You construct it much like an Erdős-Rényi graph, except that now associated with each node is a weight. So you put an edge between node I and node j with probability which is proportional to the product of their weights. And this term here just normalizes it to be a probability. And in particular, if you choose the weights, so if you now look at the expected degree of node I, then you have to sum over j to count how many edges it has. So the sums cancel out, and wi is in fact the expected degree of node I. That's why it is called the expected degree model. And in particular, if you choose the weights to have polynomial power law tails, then you get a model with degree distribution which follows a power law. Okay, and this particular model will have an edge, a node will have degree k with probability k to the minus gamma. And for this model, they also calculated the eigenvalues, so that's very useful for us. So what they did is, so the results are the following. They showed that the spectral radius, okay, so there's this parameter gamma, which tells you what the is the decay rate of the degree distribution, the exponent in the degree distribution, and you have two different regimes depending on gamma. If gamma is bigger than 2.5, then the largest eigenvalue grows like square root of m, where m is the maximum degree. If it's between 2 and 2.5, don't worry about these constants, it grows like m to the 3 minus gamma. So it grows like a power faster than square root m. Okay, so that's the main thing to remember. And what we can say about what can we say about epidemics on this graph? So our spectral radius condition, our general result tells us that if the ratio of infection rate to cure rate is smaller than the spectral radius, which is 1 over square root 10, then the epidemic dies out quickly. What about the converse? The isoperimetric constant isn't useful because the average degree of this graph is a constant. Oh, by the way, I should also mention that the maximum degree m will itself be some power of the number of nodes n in these graphs. So the spectral radius is growing like a power of n, but the isoperimetric constant is order 1. It's just some fixed number. The mean degree is order 1 in our model. So there's a big gap. But in fact, we can use the result for the star. And what we do is we pick out just the highest degree node in the graph. We look at the star around this highest degree node. If the epidemic hasn't died out on the star, then clearly it hasn't died out on the graph as a whole. So conditions which ensure that the epidemic survives for a long time on the star will also ensure that it survives for a long time on the graph. And what's the and for a star with degree m, we know of course that the threshold is at square root m. So in fact, we do get a matching threshold just by looking at the star. We get the condition that the epidemic will survive for a long time if this ratio is bigger than any bigger power of m than 1 over square root m. Okay, so we get threshold behavior in this case, and that's just by reducing the power law graph effectively to a star. And this happens for gamma bigger than 2.5. So this also tells you that the threshold is going to zero, and it's going to zero like the maximum degree to the power minus 1/2. What happens for in the range 2 to 2.5 is a bit more complicated. It's not enough to just look at a single node in that case. What the typical structure of these power law random graphs in this range is that you have a densely connected core in the middle consisting of some number of nodes growing like some smaller power of n, and outside this core there are a few tendrils. So if you look at this core contains an Edrich-Renyi subgraph, and so we can use our results for Edrich-Renyi graphs to find conditions under which the epidemic will live for a long time on the core, and if it lives for a long time on the core, then it lives for a long time on the graph. And if we do the calculations, we get that we get something that matches the general bound we get from the isoperimetric constant. So for power law random graphs, we do have threshold behavior, and we can calculate where the threshold is. So that was the first part of my talk, which is the longest. The rest is actually quite short. If there are any pressing questions, I'll take them now or I'll take them at the end. Okay, so...
I've probably been muddled about the power law, because I thought it was with the smaller power that you got the more extreme behavior. So the smaller power,
that's right,
is where you get the single, you get the single node that dominates. I thought having a sort of the n nodes dominating was.
It doesn't get well. Maybe there are some different models, and maybe they have slightly different behavior. It's not just a single node. There is a subset of nodes that dominates. Okay, so in the case where it's between, for larger values of the power, it's not that the single star is dominating. It's what happens is that you have a lot of stars around high degree nodes which are loosely connected with each other. That's what it typically looks like. And as you increase the power, it condenses more. You have a densely connected core instead of some chalk. So in one regime you have these stars. And there are short paths connecting them. And as you increase the power, you get a dense core, which is almost a complete subgraph. It's almost fully connected. And then you have a few tendrils going out of here, which are tree-like.
And then if you went further, maybe if you made gamma less than 2, you would then have the same. You would then have a single sort of star.
Possibly, but then the mean degree becomes infinite if you get gamma below 2. Yes, that could happen. Okay, so the second part of the talk is about how to allocate cure on such networks, and this is joint work with my colleagues Christian Bogues, Jennifer Chasen, David Wilson at Microsoft Redmond, and with Amin Saberi at Stanford. Okay, so this is the part where maybe you'll find the model quite unrealistic as to how we are allocating cure. So the problem we consider is the following. You have these infection rates beta, and you have a total amount of cure which we'll call D, and the question is how should you allocate this cure among the nodes. So you can choose your node-specific cure rates delta subject to the condition that they should all add up to less than D, and how should you do this so as to make the help recover from the epidemic as quickly as possible. And we can distinguish between two kinds of schemes. One is static. You're given a network, you have to go out and allocate the cure, and then you run the epidemic on the network. The other is dynamic. You may have full knowledge of which nodes are infected at any given time, and you can instantaneously reallocate cure all over the network. Clearly the dynamic scheme might be quite impractical, but fortunately we don't need the dynamic scheme. So the result is going to be that there is a simple static scheme which is close to optimal, which does almost as well as the best dynamic scheme. Just to remind you of the model again, you have a constant pairwise infection rate beta, node-specific cure rate delta, and the constraint is that the total cure rate, which might, the way you allocate cure might depend on the current state of the epidemic. This has to be bounded above by something, and it turns out that we need at least cure which is proportional to the total number of edges in the network. So that's a scaling law that we need to maintain in order to ensure that you recover from epidemic. So we'll take the constraint to be that you're allowed at least this much cure. And the objective is to choose the delta, the node-specific cure rates in such a way as to maximize the threshold, by which the threshold is the minimum value of the infection rate which will give rise to long-lived epidemics. Okay, here's a static scheme which says cure proportional to degree. So you allocate to each node U an amount of cure exactly equal to the degree of U. In that case, we can show that if the infection rate beta is smaller than 1, then the epidemic will die out quickly for any initial set of infected nodes. And this result is quite straightforward. It just comes out of the fact that if you are infecting new nodes at rate beta and getting cured, so a given node is infecting along each edge at rate beta, so it's picking a new node to infect at rate beta times its degree, and it's getting cured at rate equal to its degree. So if beta is less than 1, then the epidemic is dominated by a subcritical branching process. So it's going to die out in constant time. And the log n just comes from the maximum of n possible constants. So that tells you when epidemics die out quickly. So beta is 1 for this particular static scheme, and we want to show that this is close to optimal in the sense that no scheme can do much better. Okay, so we can't say that we can never do better in general, but at least on expander graphs we can say that at best we can do a constant factor better. That even a dynamic scheme can only push the threshold up from 1 to some other constant, where the constant will depend on the expansion properties of the graph. It will not scale in any way with n. It will just be a constant. Okay, to state the result, I need some definitions. We say a graph G is an alpha eta expander if for any subset of nodes containing at most a fraction alpha of all the nodes, the number of edges going out of that subset is at least eta times the size of that subset. So for a graph with this property, what we can show is if beta is bigger than the average degree divided by alpha times eta, which is related to the expansion parameters, then the epidemic will live for a long time. So instead of 1, we have gone up to some other constant which depends on graph properties. Okay, so that's the result. And this is for any curing strategy, even one which instantaneously reallocates resources based on which nodes are infected. Okay, just as a final point, I want to mention something about contact tracing. This is apparently a method which is used in practice in treating biological epidemics. What's done in this case is when you find an infected individual, not only do you treat that individual, but you try to identify his or her contacts and also treat the contacts. And okay, so since we looked at, we tried to find what an optimal curing strategy is, but since this is used in practice, how well does this do? So how can we model this? We chose the following model. As before, you have infection at rate beta. Now what would happen in contact tracing is you would have a cluster of nodes cured simultaneously. That's hard to model. We want a process where only one node is getting cured at a time, but what we do is in addition to curing an infected node at rate delta, there's some parameter delta prime with which a given node is cured if any of its contacts is infected, if any of the adjacent nodes is infected. So that's one, that's a simple way to model contact tracing, and this would be Markovian. But unfortunately, this is still too difficult to analyze, so we don't know what, we have no general results for this technique. And the problem comes up because this is non-monotone. In all the other epidemic models we studied so far, there was a natural monotonicity. If you start with more nodes infected, you're going to always have more nodes infected in future. But with contact tracing, you can break that. If you have more nodes infected, you might cure more nodes because you're identifying their contacts. So that makes it much harder to analyze. And the only case in which we could do it was on the star. So let me just tell you what the results are on the star. If we take the infection rate to be 1, then we find that the cure rate we need with contact tracing is cube root of n. And this compares with square root of n if we had a constant cure rate and we didn't do contact tracing. And it compares to a threshold of 1 if we allocated cure in proportion to the degree. So if we put most of the cure on the hub and very little on the leaves. So what this says is that contact tracing doesn't do as well as the optimal strategy, but it does do better than just allocating cure at a constant rate. Okay, I'm almost done. So, open problems. I was very interested in Dennis's talk yesterday where he mentioned small world networks. So, in case you weren't there, let me remind you of the small world network model. You have a finite lattice and you have additional long range contacts on the lattice which could be picked according to different distributions. In his example yesterday, it was from the uniform distribution. But you could also think of the contacts, of a contact between node X and Y having probability which depends on the distance between X and Y, perhaps decaying as some power of the distance. That's a natural generalization of that model. People have studied the diameter for such models, and you have different kinds of threshold behavior there. It would be interesting to know what happens to epidemics on such models. Our techniques are not generally good for lattice-like models, as I showed for you on the one-dimensional lattice. So you might need new and better techniques there. Just as a conjecture, I would think that there would be some kind of threshold behavior as the exponent in this distance. In the probability, so if you have so if you put an edge between X and Y with probability which is proportional to the distance to the minus alpha, then I would think that there's some threshold behavior in alpha. If alpha equals zero corresponds to the uniform, in that case you do have large epidemics quite easily. And as you increase alpha, the long-range contacts get closer and closer, and eventually there should be a point where you don't get large epidemics. And presumably there would be some kind of threshold behavior there. Well, small world networks were sort of introduced as models for social networks, so they would also be relevant to the spread of disease, but they are not really that good as models for social networks, so maybe we need better models there. Other questions relate to what happens to the epidemic in the supercritical phase. If you have, can you identify which nodes are more likely to be infected? In the case of the star, that was clearly the hub which was infected most of the time, or some constant fraction of the time. And if you could identify that, that might help you with your curing strategies. For the contact tracing, for example, we couldn't get good bounds. That's another open problem. And we've also only studied close populations. Extending it to open populations would be of interest as well. And if you're interested in the paper, it's on my website. I'll take questions now.
I've got one, but I'm not fully sure that I understand all of what you presented. But in terms of the optimal curing strategy, what you try to identify is the number of treatments you need to control the disease. Am I right to say that?
That's right. So you try to identify how much total resources you need and how best to allocate them, which nodes to allocate them to.
And then in order to identify the nodes you need to treat, in fact, you select what? You select the node in which for which the number of connection is the highest, something like that?
Or more precisely, you put in resources proportional to the number of connections it has at different nodes.
Because I was thinking about, again, this was mentioned yesterday about avian flu. Mm-hmm. And currently one of the problems is along those lines, maybe in case of a pandemic, maybe you will have some shortage and then you will have to take decision what is to be done. And identify an optimal curing strategy is an important aspect. Yeah. But I think there's also something, there's several questions. The first is who should get the treatment? And And the second is also, maybe you can consider that there is two ways to consider who should get the treatment. The one is the value in terms of reducing transmission, and the other is the value in protecting a specific person. Let's think about elderly people, So does your model is able to be extended to consider that in order to identify optimal curing strategy, you will consider not only one thing, which is the ability to limit the transmission, but also, let's say, the value of the number of people, let's say, that have been treated. You see what I mean?
I see what you mean. I think what would happen, unless if the nodes had identities saying young or old, for example, and these identities were somehow unrelated to the graph structure, then reducing the number of transmissions would have the biggest impact, because if you infect more people, you will infect a representative sample of different types of people. So there wouldn't be a case for concentrating your resources on one type of individual. That's what I expect would happen. You would only want to reduce the transmission. But if the graph structure was related to this, if there was some subgroup which contained most of the edges, then certainly they would be related to each other. And yes, you could do
consider
that.
This question. Maybe it's in some specific case you can have some trade-off and consider both things. Maybe yes, as you mentioned, in some case it's what you have to do is only to concentrate on reducing transmission. In other case, maybe to make some kind of a trade-off.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
you copy that.
So, observation about the distribution of the effort, the curing effort, that reminds me, I don't think there's a direct analogy, but it reminds me a little bit of the problem in households where we conjecture, which you can prove in some simple cases, that the thing to do with a household, the two-level model, is to vaccinate in such a way as to try and bring down the number in each household to the same level. So I suppose the analogy here would be to try and bring down the degree of nodes, so degrees were equal. So
that's effectively what you are doing.
So it's similar. It's not quite the same, but it's similar, isn't it? Observation.
How the results that you were showing in terms of those thresholds, we're always making that Markovian assumption so that the time taken to be cured was exponential, but how robust are those results? I mean, have you had a look at, say, simulations with departures from that to see if you intuitively think that they should carry over to more general situations?
No, we haven't done simulations, and I would think they are robust. So I could mention we've also started doing some work on SIR models. In that case, the upper bound, the bound for the condition under which you don't have a huge infected population, that is insensitive to the infection time distribution. It only depends on the mean. The bound can be expressed in terms of the mean. So at least in some related example, you have insensitivity. Whether in the SIS model you have insensitivity, I don't know. But
even in that case, then, you're saying that the bound
is insensitive.
Is insensitive, but yeah. The actual
okay,
the
fair
actual
enough.
Threshold might, no. might be.
Do some of your couplings go over to the case when you have, this branching process coupling? One would think that may go over to the case with non-exponential.
Yes, the branching process coupling. Yes.
That even may go over, but it wouldn't be.
I don't think that crossover. No, simulating near the critical point is quite difficult. It would take very long simulations to identify it. So I don't know. You could simulate far away from the threshold.
What were your initial conditions? Was it everybody was infected to start with, or?
Because I only looked at the mean, it doesn't matter. So for the upper bound, if you start with everybody infected, then the epidemic dies out in time log n. If you start with only one node infected, that would just be a constant rather than log n. And for when the epidemic lives for a long time, even if you start with one node infected, there is a polynomially small probability that it infects everybody, and then it lives for an exponentially long time. So that the exponent dominates. So it's you can start with just a single node infected.
But if you start, when you use this star graph embedded in as a sort of subgraph, you've got to presumably.
If you start with just one leaf infected, you have a 1 over n probability of infecting the hub, and then it lives for exponentially long. So the exponent dominates the 1 over n term. So it doesn't matter.
But if you've got to get to this star before, it wasn't.
In a power law graph, for example.
You're going to get there very quickly, okay.
Yeah, you'll get there very quickly. The diameter is quite small, so you'll get there very quickly.